The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour three. It's a delight to be with you, and it is a delight to welcome back into the studio Lewis Hallman, often here Tuesdays with his father, Hugh. Hugh is abroad, so it's me and Lewis and young David. Lewis Hallman is from Insight Analytics, where he is the managing director, INCITE Analytics, LLC. Young David, we could do this in a few languages.
You know, I think we probably could. Let me see. David Hoven would be Spanish.
Yes.
Let me see. EDR David is not quite right. That would be small David in Mandarin, but okay, that would be close. And then let me see.
Jeune David in French.
And let's see. Davidus Uenus, I think, would be Latin.
Davidus Uenus in Latin.
Yeah, something like that.
And Bocher David in Hebrew. So what do we got? One, two, three, four, five languages we can do this in.
There we go.
I think my favorite is the Latin.
Hey, I'll
Davidus Uenus.
It's not bad. Yeah, yeah. It does kind of go off the tongue a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know if it works on dating websites for him, but
Davidus. Hey, all I'm going to say is Timothy told us, let no man look down on you because you're young.
No, we don't look down on you. These are terms of endearment.
Uenus?
I can't fix Latin.
what do you want from us? Do you want us to change a dead language for you?
Yeah.
Maybe.
A romantic language, nonetheless.
How do we even know that's how it was pronounced?
Oh, we know.
We actually don't really know. What's interesting is that we have Church Latin, which then continued for a very, very long time, and has a sort of definite but warped pronunciation over the sort of the thousands of years, well, 1,500 or so years between the fall of Rome and now. But then you also see that Church Latin even is very different from what it used to be. After the introduction of the vulgar languages, when Gutenberg made his printing press, and we start to see religious services conducted in other languages as well.
There is a theory of sound, though, that no sound ever disappears. No sound uttered has ever disappeared. It just keeps breaking down into smaller and smaller particles over time. Particles probably isn't the right word, but you take the point.
Sure, sure.
So that maybe there are these echoes of days gone by. This is true of the is Aborigine a term I can use?
I believe so.
Yeah, the natives of Australia have this belief. Bruce Chatwin wrote about this, that they believe the world was sung into creation. So when they're out in the fields and then they just go on wandering walkabouts, it's because they hear some sound that kind of reminds them of the creation of the earth. I think somehow those two points are connected.
So, the other thing that you'll see you know, you could think of this with a language that's not even dead, like Greek, for instance.
Sure.
Modern Greek is very different from, for instance, Koine Greek, which is what the Bible was written in, or Attic Greek, which is ancient Greek that is sort of the style that Aristotle was writing in, which itself is very different from older forms like sort of the Mycenaean Greek and sort of then the Proto Greeks, Linear A, Linear B, all of those sorts of things. God language is fun, and this is not usually where we go on this show.
There's
but
no usual around here.
I guess not. No, you know, we can do
you're
military
not
theory.
Getting this
we
on
can
other
do love.
Stations.
We can do war. We can do linguistics.
Can
doesn't
do
really
it.
Matter.
Can we do children and mental health?
You know, I believe so. Why don't we?
I want to. I'm consumed by a few issues, mostly revolving around youth. And Abigail Schreier has a new book out, and she's pointed out, and I was talking about this a little bit in my monologue. I think there's a lot of reasons for this, but one of the quotes that I think is a takeaway quote of hers is that, if I can, quote, "American kids are the freest, most privileged kids in all history. They are also the saddest, most anxious, depressed, and medicated generation on record. What's even stranger is that all of these worsening mental health outcomes for kids have coincided with a generation of parents hyperfixated on the mental health and well-being of their children." Close quote. There is a series of, I think, truths and paradoxes in there, I think. I think she's onto something.
So I think that that's largely true. I think that there are some pieces I would quibble with.
Let's
that
do
I
it.
Think are unique.
Yeah.
So I think that if you surveyed, just random people on the street as to why America's children are stressed and depressed and anxious, most of them would probably say something to the effect of social media. Mm-hmm. And I probably would say something to that effect as well.
Mm-hmm. And but Jonathan Haidt would.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it occurs to me sitting here that there is another much less fashionable reason why children would be disproportionately likely to be stressed, depressed, and anxious compared to decades prior. And that would be family formation. Mm-hmm. You know, we can look at rates of illegitimacy and single motherhood. Pre-1950, that was about 5%, irrespective of race or ethnicity in the U.S., or sub 5%. And then at current, among Black and Hispanic communities, I believe it's north of 60 or 70%. And in non-Hispanic whites, it is currently north of 40%, and increasing. And so I would find it scarce wonder that unstable family dynamics, unstable social life would generate a higher degree of stress or anxiety or depression. Mm-hmm. And the issue with that particular explanation is that it's very easy to be able to blame social media because it's an external force that is doing things to our kids. It's mm-hmm. a very convenient villain that
yep.
way.
Yep.
But if it turns out that a large proportion of the increase, and I'm not sure, I couldn't tell you what percent of it is due to social media and what percent of it is due to changes in family formation. But if it turns out that a sizable component of this increase in mental issues is to do with family formation, then we are the authors of our own demise.
I agree with that.
And that is a very scary and morally chilling proposition.
I think we have to say it's multivariate or multivariated.
Absolutely is.
And I would also throw in religion in as well, the decline in religious attendance.
Sure.
I was fascinated. So a gentleman I've interviewed many, many times is a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, Bradley Wilcox. Mm-hmm. You familiar with his most recent book? It's titled Get Married. So Nick Kristof, who I don't usually agree with, has a column at the New York Times, liberal columnist at the New York Times. He opened up an interesting Sunday piece. Let me throw it at you if I can. It's basically a review of Wilcox's book. He said, with little notice, the United States may be crossing a historic milestone in family structure, one that may shape our health, wealth, and happiness. Historically, most American adults were married, more than two-thirds as recently as 1970. But the marriage share has crept downward, as you were saying. And today, only about half of adults are married. Depending on the data source, we may already have entered an epoch in which a majority are not married, which mm-hmm. is what you were saying. He quotes Brad Wilcox, quote, our civilization is in the midst of an epochal shift, a shift away from marriage. In place of marriage, many Americans are remaining single or simply living together without wedding rings. And to be clear, it's more of the former than the latter. And then we go through all the problems that come up with
particularly
young men.
I actually am fairly familiar with the marriage literature, yeah. And it's what's interesting is that it's not that marriage rates are declining universally among one group, and that is non-college educated people. Among college educated people, marriage rates are about as strong as they've ever been, and family formation is about as strong as it's ever been. What's really interesting about that? Have you heard of Rob Henderson's theory of luxury beliefs?
No.
Okay, great. Well, We're gonna
good.
Get to teach you something. So the notion of luxury beliefs are the idea that you can have a concept whose propagation is harmful to the poor but is not harmful to the elites. So the elites are insulated from delusional or harmful luxury beliefs. And so one of these
yes,
luxury beliefs is the notion that children raised in a one-parent household have no disadvantages relative to children raised in a two-parent household, right? This is a luxury belief that is inculcated and fostered at the university level that then college-educated people will spout, particularly if they are left-leaning. But then when it comes time to get married and have children themselves, they are almost always traditionalists. And nevertheless, they are then encouraging the people on sort of the political left minorities and the like to adopt behaviors that they themselves would not adopt as a sign of their sort of fashionable ideas. And so what's interesting is the notion of luxury beliefs is new in an age where material conditions are such that it's hard to tell if you're a rich person just by looking at them.
Okay,
luxury beliefs are the ability to really distinguish status.
All right, let me pick up on that. I'm glad you brought that up. And I guess I've heard the theory. I wasn't aware of the title or the author of it. And I want to pick on that bone with you a little bit more when we come back. Lewis Hallman from Insight Analytics, LLC, is my guest. And he and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman is my guest, H-A-L-L-M-A-N. Lewis is L-O-U-I-S. We were talking a little bit about societal formation, societal mental health, and marriage rates, church attendance rates, and fatherlessness. And you were pointing out a theory of luxury beliefs, I guess, authored by or most prominently written about by one Rob Henderson I wrote down here. So the notion of luxury beliefs, make sure I have this right, Lewis, is we have indicators and concepts and notions of how a generalized state of well-being or societal well-being will obtain. Mm-hmm. But unless I'm being Captain Obvious here or I'm misstating it, if you are in a certain economic strata or class, you can afford better to let some of those slide. Am I getting this right?
So the way I would phrase
it, the idea that these problems fall disproportionately, as the phrasing goes, on the lower quintiles.
Exactly. So a luxury belief is an idea that is unbelievably costly to members of the lower classes, but can be tolerated by an elite for the sake of fashionableness.
Got it.
Would be kind of the quick version to explain it.
Right. So if you are, I don't know, Gloria Vanderbilt and whatever, if you live if you're a multimillionaire female with a single and you're single and you have children, it's going to be perhaps negligible how much better or worse they will do than if you don't have millions of dollars.
Sure.
A degree.
One notion might be, you know, the and again, the classical idea that we were talking about in the last segment is the luxury belief that children in single-parent homes are not disadvantaged relative to children from two-parent homes.
Right.
And the reason that is a luxury belief is that it is expounded upon endlessly by the academic elite who, when it comes time to marry and form families themselves, then ignore that the prescription that being a single mother is non-damaging to children that these are there are no detriments to these sorts of activities.
Right. Okay, fair enough. But none of these, I don't know what you call them, theories or rules, none of them work quite universally, because we can always find examples of, you know,
sure, potentially
these exceptions, well, so to speak. Go ahead.
Another luxury belief might be that that the notion of gender dysphoria is so traumatizing that it is in fact worthwhile to mutilate children.
Go with that.
Might be another example of luxury belief.
Belief in what sense? That this is a phenomenon of the wealthy?
It is a phenomenon that the wealthy and educated elite endlessly encourage because it looks fashionable and good for them, much to the detriment of thousands of people who then follow the advice and then have it blow up on them.
Yeah, there was a scene in a documentary by Matt Walsh where he takes some of our transgender efforts down to some villages in Africa and shows it to them, and they just it's a language they cannot understand. It's a theory they cannot understand. It's like speaking of a squared circle or something to them.
It is certainly a profound error. You know, I worry that and of course it's always well-intentioned, over-educated, moral busybodies who are pushing this kind of thing. And the thing that is hysterical to me about it is exactly those same kind of moral busybodies who in ages past would have thought that the Tuskegee prison experiment was a good idea.
Right.
Or that any other of what, or lobotomization
right.
was a good idea,
right?
Right? Things
right.
that at the time were fashionable and in vogue
and elite,
and yep. at the crux of moral and political goodness,
right.
now then 50 years later are perceived as monstrous.
Yes.
And,
yes.
and we have this notion, again, it's kind of that hidden implicit assumption of the Martin Luther King, the arc of history has long and been towards justice, mm-hmm. that progress is inevitable in some way.
We delude ourselves
that way at our peril because, again, you know, we forget those times when fashionable, well-meaning people come together and create the most monstrous of conditions.
Well, was there a higher culture than Germany in the 1930s?
Or even in the 1890s?
Right.
Or yeah,
right.
No, there was not.
Right.
Frankly.
I mean, I think it's probably the most educated, the most theoretically civilized.
Right. Overripe in the Wagnerian sense,
right.
certainly.
Right, right. So I have to say, I think, too, with racism, by the way, when you hear claims and charges of racism, it's more likely to come from a white person like Robin DiAngelo than it is from, I don't know, a cop.
Cultural appropriation might be a great example of another luxury
yeah.
belief, for instance, right? In the notion, the whole idea behind the notion of cultural appropriation is that you shouldn't do things that are from a minority culture that is not your own, which then prevents us from enjoying and appreciating one another and actually doing the sort of the casual living together that then fosters real diversity rather
yeah.
than sort of the tokenized diversity that is so fashionable.
This you saw a little bit with Amy Coney Barrett when she was nominated to the Supreme Court. She had adopted a couple of children from Haiti, if I'm mm-hmm. not mistaken. And Ibram Kendi, the professor at Boston University who has made all this money promoting the notion of racism in America, he wrote a terrible thing on Twitter that she was robbing
right.
these black children of their cultural heritage
right.
and identity.
Better that they should have their cultural heritage and be eating rats in Haiti. Or Ibram X. Kendi perhaps could adopt them,
right.
maybe, if that
right.
would be better. But I don't think that I see him taking that particular moral high ground.
Right.
It's very easy to scold and wag your finger at someone. It's much harder to actually do something.
But that is at the heart of this cultural appropriation argument in some respects, isn't it? And it doesn't remain consistent because you get this, I guess, with Broadway and movies and Broadway now, right? Where you have to theoretically have someone of that color represent or ethnicity, someone of that color or ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
You see this argument from time to time. I guess it didn't work with Hamilton for some reason, but
yeah, it's.
But you do see this.
There is a mad push to do it for all sorts of reasons. You know, there's some notional idea about representation again that compels people to do a lot of this, and so much of this stuff to me is cheap culture war fodder, right? That it's not, you know, if Ariel and the Little Mermaid remake is black or not doesn't particularly bother me, right? This is not something I ultimately care about one way or the other. What is interesting though is the degree to which companies that trade on being neutral will then sort of betray that notion. And
yeah,
then
and all of it does. Yes, all of it does bend. I'm using that arc bending. Is it a metaphor? That arc bending metaphor for a moment because all of this is bending towards more race consciousness. And I wonder if we could pick up on that when we come right back.
Sure, absolutely.
Race consciousness used to be the thing we wanted to get rid of, and it now seems to be more prevalent than ever. And we wanted to get rid of it based on the guy who created the phrase that the arc of justice bends towards – or the arc of history bends towards justice. Let me pick up on that with you when we come right back. Lewis Hallman is my guest, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman, my guest, he the managing director at Insight Analytics, INCITE, Insight Analytics, LLC. We got pretty hard and fast into the culture here. This is kind of interesting, culture wars, which, by the way, I would proffer, you probably have a better sense of the history than I do, but I would proffer that the cultural wars right now, I mean, just look at the whole Easter contretemps with the White House and Trans Awareness Days. I would say they're almost at a more fevered pitch now than they've ever been. We can put a pin in that grenade and come back to it, because I want to stick with the race thing for just a second. This notion that the arc of history always bends towards justice, as famously uttered by Martin Luther King. I don't know if he invented it, but it's attributed to his making it popular. At the same time, he was trying to make us less race conscious. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that we are as race conscious now as we probably were in the 1950s before he had his successes in the 1960s. Some of it is related to this cultural appropriation nonsense.
Yeah, so...
Or misappropriation nonsense.
I think what's going on there is really an expansion of sort of the woke concept. And let me provide a working definition for woke for people, just so that as Republicans we can sort of come on the same page and understand what we're criticizing. When I say woke, what I'm talking about is the tendency of the left to use Marxist material analysis, right? The notion that that oppressed classes necessarily will create revolutions, and applying that not only to economic concepts of class, but then also to an intersectional framework. And by that, I mean sexual orientation, race, and any other variable that one chooses to use. And so what I'm criticizing, again, is the adoption of that Marxist framework of analysis, the materialist lens, and taking that not only through the economic angles that Marxism uses and that communism uses, but then also applying that to such things as race, gender, et cetera, so that every facet of human life then becomes this, the to stereotype, the oppression Olympics, you know, oppression games, where one is most celebrated and one is most status worthy by being the most victimized, which then creates all sorts of problems.
Does that circle back to the original point?
Yeah, absolutely.
About the mental health conditions. And so you were
making...
Because a lot of them are striving to have the special designation.
Well, you were making the point that racial consciousness is elevated to a high degree.
Yep.
And my point is that the reason it is elevated is because they are using that Marxist lens on the concept of race as part of their core political philosophy. Right?
Yeah.
The idea that there are oppressor and oppressed races, and that necessarily will demand conflict that must be resolved in favor of the oppressed.
See, I never really saw any great distinction between Nazism and Marxism, except for the fact that they merely replaced race for class. The racial struggle in Marxism with the economic struggle in racism with the racial struggle in Nazism.
Well, we've talked about this before. We have a really difficult time in the U.S. and in the West more broadly, I think, condemning communism because of the World War II experience, right? Because Joseph Stalin was ostensibly on our side and a monster, most people's brains are not wired to handle the level of moral ambiguity and compromise that has to occur at sort of that real politic level of nation states. And so the fact that Uncle Joe not only killed 20 million of his own people, but was also our ally against Hitler, reconciling the two of those things is extraordinarily difficult for the American people. And so it's much easier if we just sort of don't give the communists and the Nazis the same sort of moral equivalence. We can't, because one of them was on our side and the other wasn't. And so in order to keep that memory of our
You're
own
saying
history.
We can't as an observer, not as a recommendation.
As an observer, right? It is very difficult. Yeah. Like, most Americans could not reconcile the horror of what the Soviets did with the fact that we were allied to them as a core partner of achieving global stability.
No, but
and that is why the communists get a pass.
Yeah, it's true. We only got a Victims of Communism memorial within the last 10 years or so. And if you look at the body count, it outweighs the Nazi body count by a factor of probably 10.
The issue is, do we have to, like... let's come back to this.
Let's come back to this. This is a big one.
Yeah.
Lewis Hallman is my guest. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman is my guest. And I'm not sure how to remind or revive how we closed the last segment with this one, but I guess I would try it this way. We have at ASU at least two communist clubs that I know of. They have Vladimir Lenin Days, where they commemorate Vladimir Lenin's works. They have a Karl Marx picture and a hammer and sickle at the opening initiation.
You even have commercial products.
You have Teen Vogue invoking Marx all the time. You have New York Times, what Karl Marx got right. None of that would ever apply to fascism, Nazism, or Adolf Hitler. You just wouldn't see it.
Right.
That's the best way to
say
it.
Not in polite society anyway.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Right.
You know, it would be beyond the pale if someone was making those. But instead in the U.S., you know, we have Leninade, right? Lenin-themed lemonade that you can have. Communism is viewed as a kitschy joke rather than as a serious historical force.
Right.
And again, it's
T-shirts
it's,
of Che Guevara.
Right. It is because we were allied to the USSR during World War II, and that sort of joined us against the Nazis and always and forever in our political consciousness made the Nazis worse than the communists because we had to ally with the communists to fight the Nazis, which means that the Nazis must have been worse. It's that simple.
And we got – yes, go keep going unless you want me to – go ahead.
And if you actually try to educate people and unpack the true horror of – the communist regimes of the Khmer Rouge, of Mao Zedong, of Joseph Stalin, you then have to reconcile that the U.S. as a mature nation in a very complicated, morally gray world sat down and made a deal with the devil that was Joseph Stalin so that we could defeat another devil. And it is very, very tough for a lot of people to I think reconcile that.
Yes, and or but I'm not sure which one. You have very, very smart people with all their senses firing who will still justify Marxism, communism, the Soviet Union, went to the Soviet Union, came back and said they saw the future, and it works. You had Bernie Sanders coming back. I mean, it's so interesting. Bernie Sanders lives in Vermont, about 100 miles away from Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Mm-hmm.
Never once visits him, but does fly thousands of miles to go to the Soviet Union to have his honeymoon and come back and tell us bread lines are actually good. You have smart people justifying that I don't think you would have seen much of with Nazism. Maybe a little Lindbergh, maybe, but not at the scale you have communism.
Hold on. At the time, you know,
it was all, yes.
If you actually look at sort of, you know, 1942 and earlier, I would say, and especially in the 30s before the Second World War really breaks out, you know, there was a substantial minority of U.S. public opinion that did in fact side with Hitler. It's very strange to read those sorts of letters and records now, but that is the history as it was and as we should understand it. Because if we try to reform our civic memory, you know, against what actually happened, then not only, you know, are we doing ourselves a disservice and lying about those who came before us, but we're also blinding ourselves to the very human foibles that may occur and crop up in our own timeline.
Fair enough. I accept that. But two things are additionally true. There wasn't a fifth column Nazi movement in America to the degree there was a Soviet fifth column in America, one. Two, in the light of all we know about both regimes, one still has more adherents than the other.
So we also might talk about why that is. First of all, the Soviets and the Nazis had a very, very different mechanisms and structures for military intelligence. And that's part of the reason, right? I don't want to make the case that ideologically there is something about communism that attracts dissidents and, you know, wreckers, quote unquote, where fascism does not. This has also to do with the spy structure of those countries more than the ideology.
Yes, of course.
Ultimately,
and the short-livedness of Nazism.
Right. You know, that's true. It also did not get –
yeah.
We also, you know
– it had 12 years or
well,
something.
Well, also the highly publicized Soviet espionage is post-World War II in the Cold War regarding nuclear secrets, which then was not a platform for espionage that existed when Nazism was around. So it's hard to say. You can't really – apples to apples is very, very tricky,
Fair
would
enough.
Say.
Fair enough. the original point that sprang this discussion was mine, that I think is still holding true. The observable difference is relevant, as you point out, but that Nazism basically was Marxism replacing class with race. Do you disagree with that?
Nazism was basically Marxism replacing class with race. I don't think I do. I think what Nazism was a the sort of Marxian power play, but done at the level of nations. And what I mean by that is there is a sort of international, global component within Marxism where it is described as sort of it's the workers of the world unite, right? The notion is that eventually, you know, the revolution of the proletariat is such that it will dissolve national boundaries itself. And fascism or Nazism specifically, you do see it done at the level of the ethnicity. So I guess in that level, I suppose I am forced to agree that to a large degree, it's what are the material conditions, right, that are then causing that dominate politically. The communist will say it is class consciousness, right, the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. The fascist will say it is a conflict between peoples.
Okay. So the point I've been trying to bring down on all of this is that it seems like we are taking large degrees of both ideologies and imposing them on our youth once again in a way that we didn't used to. We are re-racializing and re-class warfaring our society in a way that we tried not to do anymore.
I will definitely agree with that. And that is why I wanted to give that definition of wokeism in a prior segment, which again is the articulation of Marxist class struggle to other domains of inquiry. So this would be using the oppressor-oppressed class dynamic on race or sex or gender or what else, whatever have you. And so that is the crux of it. And it is that instinct that is totalizing and that is certainly hiving us apart. What ultimately, and again, we've talked about this before, what that sort of woke notion fails to understand is that the individual is the ultimate minority, and that if you run the exercise to its logical conclusion and you fractionate everyone on all of the different domains upon which they can be oppressed, you then find that the categories get so small that it's one person per category. We're at the individual, and we must then act with and treat one another as individuals. The fact that they haven't got there just shows that they're more in love with the notion of the materialism, the notion of the conflict, than they are with thinking through the world and understanding mechanically how it works. It is a prescriptive, not a descriptive ideology.
We'll pick up on that with a closing thought when we come right back. Portions of this show brought to you by our good friends at Y Refi. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a ring at 888-YREFI-24. Y Refi offers up a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. With YRefi, you can turn your income on or off. You can compound it. With YRefi, there are absolutely no fees, and there's no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. Check them out. Again, investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com. Lewis Hallman has been my guest. We did a big tour of cultural cleavages in our country. The last thing I want to say, and it's a short segment, so I'll let you be liberal with however you want to address it, about the way we seem to have detoxified Marxism or communism in this country in a way that we haven't and didn't with Nazism or fascism, seems to be newer. It seems to me this country did have more than an allergy to communism for a very long period of time, including such notions as better dead than red, including such notions of it being a dirty word once upon a time. It seems to have been cleansed.
I think after the collapse of the USSR, okay, when we stopped having real communists as real enemies, okay, facing us down with bullets and nukes, is when a lot of the impetus came off to really sort of let the joke out, as it were,
yeah,
and to make it more of that kitschy thing,
uh-huh,
right? Not that the great enemy is dead and rotting in his grave. It's a lot easier to make fun of him.
Mm-hmm.
I would point out, though, that...
Or to think it's not a threat.
Right, right.
Right.
To the degree that it's not a threat. Well, I think we're wrong about that.
I do too.
Communism is absolutely
still
a threat.
We're in fierce agreement on that.
It is a threat to no one more so than its own people. Mm-hmm. Let me give you one statistic about the CCP that I just learned the other day that was alarming to me. So not only have they so mismanaged their economy that they have five times as many spare housing units as the rest of the world combined, a total of 1.5 billion, but they have so mismanaged their society and had so many totalitarian overcorrections due to COVID that in the last 5 years, the Chinese birth rate has declined more and it is lower than it was for the Jews of Europe during the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Civil society depends on liberty. It depends on freedom. Our prosperity depends on our ability to keep our free society going. Communism has a cost, and they are paying it.
I'm going to let you take us out.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. That will be all, and God bless, and class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.